Help me welcome our speaker tonight, Rob from Working With Others Group in Necton, New Jersey.
Rob Van Hook, alcoholic. It's only been through the grace of a kind and loving God, strong sponsorship. 12 steps, 12 traditions, and active participation in my home group. I haven't found it necessary to pick up a drink since March 10th of 2009, and for that I'm truly, truly grateful. And thanks for having me out, Jeff. Jeff came out to my group on Thanksgiving. So, we were grateful to have me deliver an awesome message, and I've been here before. I came out, I want to say about 5 or 6 years I was out here, and it was out in, you know, the overhang. It was summertime, and it was a really neat meeting. I think Steve F. was speaking that night, and it was a mood light. So it's like it's an honor to be asked to do anything for Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's definitely an honor to be here tonight. And I thank you guys. My home group is the Working With Others group. It meets in Necong, New Jersey on Thursday nights at 8 o'clock, and it's a traditional open speaker meeting, much like this. And you got to have 10 years actually to at least to speak at our podium, and that way we know we're going to get a consistent message. Anyone who talks to, they're going to be talking about hope. You're going to be talking about recovery. They're going to be talking about the work in the steps, sponsorship, and the big book. And we know that when we get speakers there. It's a really neat deal, you know. I'm a little nervous. It's kind of cool. I speak all the time. I'm seldom nervous, but I kind of like it. You know, they say that's like maybe God shaking the truth out of me. We'll see. Fingers crossed. I'm just gonna tell you a little bit about like what I was like, you know, while I was drinking, you know, how I felt, you know, why I drank, why I believe I drink now, you know, and I'm gonna tell you like what happened to bring me into Alcoholics Anonymous, and then I'm gonna tell you what life is like now that I'm here, I'll just start at the beginning, I suppose. I grew up in Colorado. I'm a small kind of typical, everyday, dysfunctional family, I suppose, you know. I have an older brother. I have a father. I was always told he was an alcoholic. He drank a lot. He caused a lot of grief to my mom. I never really saw that part. He kind of hid that, or he was out of the house a lot, you know, when he was drinking. I never really knew it never felt weird to me. It never felt off, but like, one thing that I like to point out about it is that he had some conditions where he had to quit drinking, you know, medical conditions. He was on like a lot of blood thinners, you know, heart problems, and the doctor said, you know, you gotta quit drinking. And he did. Like that, you know, it's like he never went to AA, he never did any sort of treatment for it, he just was able to stop. That was certainly not my experience with alcohol. I was given lots of reasons to quit, and I certainly had a harder time with it than being able to do it on my own. I tried doing it on my own for years, and things did not get better for me. They got a lot worse over time. Basically what ended up happening was I realized I couldn't quit in spite of all the reasons I had to quit. And so I just kind of accepted that, and I assumed, you know, accepted my lot in life that I was just going to end up dying drunk. And I wasn't happy about that, but I accepted it, if that makes sense. That's so drab. It's New Year's Eve. Let's get to the fun part. It was fun at first. It was a lot of fun at first. In fact, if it wasn't fun at first, like, I think you missed the point, you know. I loved drinking. I did. I remember that magical day. I was 15, and I have a very, very typical first time drinking story. It was, you know, one of my friends' parents was out of town. There was about 5 of us. We raided the liquor cabinet, and this dude's friend, like dad, had a really well stocked liquor cabinet. He was probably an alcoholic himself, but we didn't want to make it obvious that we were raiding the liquor cabinet. So what we did is we took one big glass and we poured a little bit of like each bottle into it. And so I don't know what it was that I drank, but it was green. I remember that. And then like there was a Pepsi. So it like we got in a circle and you take like 2 drinks and then the Pepsi would come along as a chaser. And I was like, I couldn't wait. I always loved the way alcohol smelled. It smelled very adult, you know, and I knew that like something was going to, I intuitively knew something was going to happen that night. Maybe it's just because I was doing something that I knew I wasn't supposed to. I don't know, but I was really looking forward to it. And what happened is like, it came around to me and I remember taking that first drink and it burnt me right here in the jowls. It just like tingled and burnt, and it burnt my throat and my chest and my stomach, and then like do one of those, and then like it was awful. It did not taste anything like I was hoping it would, you know. It tasted really, really bad. So I like took another drink and then passed it along, and then took a, you know, chased it down with some Pepsi, and then like it went around I don't even know how many times, and here's what happened. It's like 10-15 minutes, something happened to me. I don't know if this happened to my friends, but I know it happened to me. And I've heard a lot of people, you know, share about this at the podium, and I think it's really important, because this was my first spiritual experience I had with alcohol. What happened is like this whole lifetime of fear and anxiety and overanalyzing situations and being in my head and just noise that I didn't even know I was in this. Like this fear just melted off of me. And I looked around, and it's like everything was almost in slow motion, and everything was really bright, and everything was just like perfect. And like I said, I don't know if this happened to the rest of my friends. They're like, "Are you feeling it?" And I'm like, "Yeah." And like, "You feeling it?" And they're like, "Yeah." I am pretty sure we had different experiences that night, because none of them ended up in AA. None of them ended up being alcoholics. But for me, it was a pretty amazing thing. And it felt like, because objectively now I know, like looking back, what happened is that like I wasn't in my head and I was in the moment. And so kind of for the first time, I could kind of come out and be friends with my friends instead of worrying about them, like worrying about me. Essentially, it's like, what are they thinking? What are they thinking about me? You know, what am I thinking about me? How am I measuring up? I didn't even realize all this was going on until it just disappeared. And that was a pretty neat experience, you know. None of us had really strong alcoholic role models to look up to, so we just kind of winged it that first night and ran around the neighborhood breaking into cars and just having fun. No consequences. We were, 15? You know, it was just a good night. One other thing I always like to talk about when I speak, excuse me, that first night, something happened to me that didn't happen to my friends. And what that was is, I don't know, at the end of the night, I mean, this is everyone's first time drinking, so everyone's as drunk as they've ever been in their life. And they're all going to bed. And I went upstairs. They were going to sleep in the basement. I went upstairs, and I made myself another drink. At the time, I couldn't tell you why. It was just like, I didn't have enough. It was like, if one drink did this, what's two going to do? You know, I mean, I didn't have a good reason for needing another drink, but I took it, you know, and none of my other friends seemed to need that either. And obviously, since coming to AA and learning something about alcoholism and reading the big book, you know, and the doctor's opinion, I know that was like kind of the earmarks of what the doctor's opinion refers to as the allergy, you know. It's like this phenomenon of craving that, like, once I start drinking, I get thirstier and thirstier and thirstier. If that happens to you, you know, the big book kind of points out that's like, that only happens to alcoholics. And again, it's like, my friends could be like, "Are you feeling it?" "Yeah, you?" "Yeah." You know, it's like, I didn't realize they were having a different experience than I was. But they were not, that aspect of alcoholism was not a part of their story. But it wasn't mine. And it got worse over time. There was even a period where, like, while it was there and I could feel that urge to drink while I was drinking, I still had, like, a limit. You know, I knew when I had enough, or like I knew if I drank anymore I'd have a hangover, or you know, stuff like that, and I could force myself to stop, you know. And this is like when I'm, you know, in a teenager, I had all this figured out, but somewhere along the line I crossed some sort of line where it's like once I start drinking I couldn't stop. I mean, it was like I would stop if I ran out or ran out of money or fell asleep, you know, or went to jail. I mean, that's what stopped me from drinking. And you guys too. it got on top of me. It was progressive. You know, but like I said, I had a lot of fun, and I used to say I didn't have a lot of consequences. Excuse me. I don't know why I thought that. Because like before, I said that once at a podium, and it hit me before I even turned 18. I was like, I was in and out of like mental hospitals, like four of them, and like for like the drug and alcohol, basically rehabs out in Colorado. My mom, my poor mom, she tried so hard to give me help, but she was an alcoholic. She didn't know how to help, you know. So she, you know, she sent me to wilderness survival programs. She even at one point turned me over as a ward of the state, you know, as living in a group home. She didn't know what to do with me. I was in detoxes. I was in jail. You know, it was by like the age of 18. It's like, but no consequences, because it's like it didn't feel like anything bad was actually happening. It just felt like part of, you know, it just went with, you know, the job. It's things that I had to do to you know, drink the way I wanted to drink. But really, what I wanted was not to have my family, not to have my mom like on my back, so I could kind of do what I wanted to do. And what brought me out to Jersey was I got in. Accepted to art school when I was about 24, I think, and so I'd already been drinking pretty much a daily user, you know, for about 10 years at this point. Obviously, at 15, it's like a lot easier to do other things than drink every day. But by the time I turned 21, it was like alcohol was always there. It was just always there, and you know, a lot of my friends were starting to ask me, you know, those really hard questions, you know, like, hey, Rob, you having a little trouble with your drinking? Kinda, you know, I mean, like, alcohol's involved a lot, you know, but it's like, it doesn't really feel like my problem, you know? Or like, hey, Rob, you drinking as much water as you are beer? That was a tough one, because I realized I wasn't, I mean, I didn't really have much of a drink till like, you know, probably the last, you know, 10 years, I'd say. I was like mostly a rum drinker, because, you know, I'm a pirate, but I always was drinking, you know, and I was, when I came out here, I was like, it was already out of control, and I was, you know, starting to drink in the morning and stuff like that, and I kind of used the New Start sort of as like a geographic tour to try to not, you know, just start over. Just to, you know, I was just going to leave that, you know, my whole life in Colorado as I moved out to Jersey to go to art school. And I was able to quit, you know, I was for about 3 or 4 days until, like, I realized how uncomfortable I was in college, how competitive it was, and how I went from being, like, one of the best artists in my whole school to being, like, a mediocre artist in, like, an art school, you know, and it was just, like, and all of a sudden, I'm like, well, what's everyone thinking about me? What am I thinking about me? How am I measuring up, you know? And I knew how to turn that down. I knew how to shut that voice down. And that was just, you know, a couple drinks, you know? And I walked up to the liquor store, and I don't even think my mom drove up there with me to kind of get me settled, and I don't think she left town before I, you know, started drinking. But once she was gone, man, it was like I was kind of off. I was just off for the next 3 years while I was in school. And I used alcohol to fuel that artistic creativity. I was a better artist when I was drunk, I thought. But I don't know if there's any artist types, but you'll like probably realize, no, that's just not the case. It just seems that way at the time. And which is sort of like was my motto for, or my mantra, rather, for a long time. It seemed like a good idea at the time. And I don't know, kind of to pass forward, I graduated school. Again, people out here are starting to ask me those same questions, like, geez, Rob, you drink a lot, you have a little trouble with your drinking? Kind of, helps me draw. And I graduated, got a job right after graduation. I met a girl shortly thereafter in a liquor store. She was working there, and I was like, all right, I'll get in her line, right? And she used to think that I was stalking her. She said to me, she's like, you would come in like two, three, sometimes four times a day, you know? And it's like, I knew you liked me. And I'm like, yeah, that was why. But it's funny because, like, I used to spread out my, like, liquor store. Because I always tried to, like would try to, like, taper off, you know, or be like, oh, I'm only going to buy a six-pack or a small bottle or whatever. And then I start drinking, and then, like, I'd finish it, and then I'd have to go get more. And it was, like, really no big deal because there's liquor stores everywhere. But you know, then there's this, you know, I don't know, maybe I was stalking a little bit. Who knows? But anyway, she ended up pregnant, and there was a... another reason to quit. There was another reason to stop drinking, and it had a timeline to it of 9 months, and I really gave it my all. And her dad died of alcoholism when she was like, you know, a kid, when she was like 12, cirrhosis. And so she and her family really did not care for me drinking the way I was drinking. And so I had a lot of motivation, a lot of reason to quit. But what I found is that when my daughter was born, I hadn't even been able to quit more than 3 or 4 days together, maybe 5. 5 was about my record. And when she was born, you know, the need to celebrate was there. It's just the best I could do, I suppose, you know. I don't know if there's any drunk drivers here. I was a big, I like drunk driving. Yeah, them too. I was good at it. I knew all the tricks. You know, you like, you pull, instead of holding the steering wheel up top, you hold it on the bottom and pull down it, and you like, can look with one eye and you make all the lines go into one line, and you can like, drive a little better and drive a little over the speed limit because they're not looking for speeders, right? You know, and like I knew all the tricks and I was really good at it. I was the guy at the party who would take everyone's keys and then like when we run out of booze, I'll get it, you know? And it's like, but when you put a newborn in the car under those circumstances, it's a whole different game. And I did that. And like I'll be like, I'll buy a bottle and that way I'll have enough, you know, I'd be the only one watching my daughter and I'd run out. And I would have to get more, and like she'd be asleep in her crib, and I'd be like, well, do I run out to the liquor store and back before she wakes up, or do I take her with me and hope I don't get caught? And I tried both, and I'm not proud of that. And I didn't do it because I thought that was a good idea. I knew it was wrong, but I needed more, and that's just how powerful this stuff was over me, you know. And people are, you know. Like every relationship I ever got into up to that point, I got to choose between the girl and the drink. And like every relationship up until that point, I ended up choosing the drink, not with my words, but with my actions. And that relationship dissolved. And all the friends that I had made out in Jersey had gone home, you know, by this point, and I was pretty much just drinking alone. I got real lonely around that time, and I was drinking. I didn't really want to die. I mean, I didn't want to live, and like, I didn't know how to stop drinking, but I didn't want to keep drinking. I was in that like kind of jumping off point that they talk about in the big book. I was in, and that lasted for me for a lot longer than I was comfortable with. I mean, any moment is uncomfortable, but it really lasted with me, and I tried controlling it, and I tried stopping, I tried tapering, and it's like I made oaths and promises and everything else, and I just always went back to it. I always went back. And again, people like I remember at work, and you know, my boss is like, "Rob, you having a little trouble with your drinking?" Not really. You know what it was like? I make a firm resolution to quit, or maybe promise the girl to quit, or my boss, or my mom, or friends or family, whatever, and I would be fine the next day. I could go a day, no problem. 2 days, it was like, oh, I just got to get over the hump, you know. But it's like, man, 3 days. 3 days, it got real uncomfortable. And by the, like, midway on the third day, it's like, it wasn't like there was even anything wrong with me. But there was a lot wrong with you guys. And, like, Jersey all of a sudden would be filled with idiots everywhere I went. Like out in Colorado, for instance, like the roads are spread out. Everyone's like kind of at a slower pace. Everyone's just nice, you know, and everyone drives real, real well. And it's like, but not in Jersey, man. It was like everything's all, you know, fast paced, close together, and everyone just drives like an idiot, especially at 3 days sober. 4 days sober, it's even worse. And like, it's like they know. And like, so I'll drive with all these idiots, and I get to work, and then like my boss, he's being an idiot. You know, because he's wanting me to do things, and then I have like another boss who's like telling me to do something contrary to the other boss, and like they're not communicating because they're idiots, and like it's like, what do they want? I have like 3 bosses, and, like, they're all idiots too, and they're all asking me to do things that I don't want to do. And the whole time I'm at work, I just want to be home, you know. So it's like I finally like get off of, you know, work a full 3-hour day, and I leave and I go home, and again there's like road is just full of idiots. And then I get home, and then like I was still living with my daughter's mom for a little while after we broke up, you know, for my daughter's sake, right? It's like really I couldn't afford to live on my own. But she was being an idiot too. I mean, she didn't even work all day, or the 3 hours that I did. And like, but she's asking me to go out to the store to get things. I was like, couldn't you call me and tell me like earlier? She's like, she's being a total idiot. So like, I go to the store. I need like 3 things, right? And I'm, and like, the store is just full of idiots. I'm walking down the aisle, and there's like a, 2 people walking down the same aisle side by side with carts. And it's like, you can't get around them. And neither one of them is moving. So I had to go all the way around the other, you know, like to the next aisle to get the thing that I need. And it's like, I just want to get in there and get out. And it's like, and I get in the express lane, you know, the 12 items or less. And the person in front of me has 15 items. I know because I counted it twice. They're being an idiot. And the person ringing them up is being an idiot because they're actually ringing them up. They're not getting the manager. The manager is probably an idiot too. And it's like, I just got to get out of there. And I just like, I promised everyone I wouldn't drink. I wouldn't drink anymore. And I get through that line, there's this old lady who's going like super slow. She's reading her receipt while she's an idiot. And it's like, and then like, I walk by and like, I see it. ShopRite Liquors. I promise, but I'm already breathing again, you know? And I go in there and that same little old lady, she was like, she's, you know, trying to get a bottle off the top shelf that she can't reach. And she wasn't like that bad, you know? So I help her out and I give it to her, and then like I get in line to check out. I got my bottle of rum because I'm a pirate, and I get up to the counter, and some lady's buying like probably $500 worth of scratch tickets, and like, but it's okay. I hope she wins, you know. And I get in the car, and you know, I crack it open, and I take a few drinks. When I get home, and she's like, Rob, you promise? You having a little trouble with your drinking? Not really. You know what my problem was? When I wasn't drinking, and I was trying to just live life the way everyone else seems to live life. And then, like, once I got in, I didn't even have to drink the alcohol. I just had to see it. And, like, I'm already better. See, because like for a guy like me, not drinking doesn't solve my problem. Not drinking starts my problem. And life is a problem for me. It's just like in some people, it just comes so easy. For me, for some reason, I don't know. I'm just different. And but that's okay, you know. And March 9th, 2009, I was picking up my daughter from daycare again, drunk, of course. I picked her up drunk a lot, and they talked to me a few times about it. And but usually what I do is I just throw in some gum, and I just try to beeline in and out as quick as I could. But this day it didn't work out. The director of the daycare, this little old pistol of a lady, she comes out, and she's like, stop right there, you know. And she's like, I saw you coming a mile away. You were not picking up your daughter like this. And I'm like, oh, it's fine. I'm not, you know, I just had a glass of wine with lunch. You know, I've been drinking vodka all day, but like, I'm arguing with her that I'm not drunk. She's like, Rob, let it go. You're not getting there. We're going to call the grandparents. I'm like, no, it's fine. It's fine. I'm like, I live close. I'll take back roads. And she's like, Rob, let it go. Let it go. Let it go. Okay, this next part's important to my story, I believe, because this is the second spiritual experience I had that I can recall relating to alcohol. And I'm going to try to explain as best I can, and I can't explain it exactly. All I can do is kind of point at it from different directions. But it was like, what happened is like my shoulders slumped, and it was like I felt like I had been crying for 2 hours, although I hadn't been. It's that feeling. And it felt physically lighter. And it was like this, people my whole life were trying to shine this little light on this like drinking thing, on this alcoholism thing. And when they would, I would skirt the issue because I didn't want that area of my life illuminated. I wanted to keep that secret because I was embarrassed about it, because some people could just quit drinking. I couldn't. But for whatever reason, in this moment, I stopped defending the fact that I wasn't an alcoholic. And then I was able to kind of surrender in that moment to the fact that I was. And this idea that it was just going to have to be this way, and that I would have to drink until I died, and that's just the way things were, was replaced by this other idea It was like almost, it wasn't an idea. It didn't feel like it came from me. It felt like it was just sort of piped in to my mind from somewhere else. And the idea was this, maybe it doesn't have to be that way. And for some reason, I entertained that thought. I entertained it and I gave up, you know, and I stopped fighting. And you know, my daughter's grandpa picked her up and he said those magical words to me. He said, dude, you reek. It's like, I was drinking vodka. Vodka doesn't smell. How could he smell it on me? You know? It's just been oozing out of my system for years, you know, and there's no hiding. The only person who didn't know, obviously, like, well, I mean, I knew, but, like, I didn't think anyone else knew. Everyone knew. But I was just defeated. I didn't have any fight left. I was suicidal at that point. You know, I was looking to end my life and but in a non-selfish way. Cause like, well, I had a daughter. So I had a license, I had insurance, and I had a car all at the same time, which is, you know, not even 50% with us who come in that condition. But I had full insurance too, full coverage, which was like, death and dismemberment would be $10,000 if I die in a car accident. And if I had my seatbelt on, it'd be $20,000. And that was, I thought, the best I could do for my daughter. But I wasn't quite courageous enough to kill myself. Like, so I'd go for a little bit of liquid courage. And then what would happen is I'd get this sort of sense of ease and comfort would wash over me. And I would be okay for a little while. And I wouldn't want to die for a little while. So in a perverse way, alcohol was actually almost keeping me alive at the end, even though it was killing me. And it was crushing my spirit, my soul. And that day at the daycare, I was just like, I had nothing left. And there were like, when they say mentally, emotionally, physically, spiritually bankrupt, I mean, that's just where I was. And I went home. She never called the cops. She never called DIFUS out of all the times I got caught. And the next day I had an appointment to talk to her and I found out why. She said, I went in there and she, you know, she told me in no uncertain terms, I will not be picking up my daughter from daycare anymore. I could drop her off, but I couldn't pick her up. And she explained to me that, you know, she started telling me a little bit about her brother and he was an alcoholic. And she told me about his drinking and the effect that that had on him and their family. And how it, you know, kind of ruined things. And then she mentioned that he came into AA. And he had been sober about 30 years at that point. And she told me the effect that that had on him and her and the family. And I could see myself in a lot of what she was saying, you know, and she was 12-stepping me. She was relating someone else's experience, but it was like she was still able to 12-step me. I was still able to see myself in that and identify. And when she suggested that maybe I go to Alcoholics Anonymous, it wasn't a bad idea. And then she suggested, it's like, look, you're drinking during the day. Maybe you should go to a day meeting. And like, that wasn't a bad idea either. You know, better than what I had. I was out of ideas, you know. And it's like, anytime I'm working with a guy now and they're suicidal, I'm kind of secretly like, yes. So don't get me wrong. It's a horrible place to be. But it's like, when you're suicidal, man, you are out of ideas. And you're a lot more, it's almost like AA is like built for people like us. You know, it's like the worse off you are, the further down you go, the better AA will work for you. Because like more likely you are to do it, you know. And since I understand what they say when they say that gift of desperation, because it is a gift. And I was desperate and I went to my first AA meeting and a lot of people say it's like, my best thinking got me here. And it's like, I know what they mean when they say that. And I understand that and I absolutely agree in one respect, but in the other it's like I almost have to say my best thinking kept me out, because like I thought I could do it on my own. I thought I was just weak willed, and if I just tried harder, you know, I could keep drinking. And then like that night or that day of the first meeting, you know, it's like I was going to open the door and I'm like, wait, what if someone sees me, you know? And it's like my best thinking was trying to keep me out. And it was almost like, again, I mean, today I know simply that it was so that the hand of God opened that door for me and helped me walk in, because it was like my idea was to run, you know, and to not face that responsibility. First meeting was okay. I felt comfortable. No one really said hello to me. It wasn't like coming here tonight. A bunch of people who never met me before, like, reached out their hand, and I met some people, and it's like a very, very welcoming and very warm reception here. And I don't know what it was at that meeting. Like, maybe I just flew in under the radar or something, but I didn't get that reception, and I was fine with that. But at the same time, it's like I always try to, in my home group, when I see someone that I haven't met, I'm just going to meet them. You know, I'm going to give them a smile. I'm going to give them a handshake, because, like, you never know. You never know what can actually make or break, you know, someone's day or someone's start in sobriety. And I felt safe. I felt like I didn't have to drink that hour. And then I go home, and I had I could sleep for 8 hours fairly well. I'd wake up and the bed would just be soaked because I'd be sweating so bad. You know, I detoxed at home. I don't recommend it. I was about 5-6 days into sobriety and I found out that could actually kill you. Who knew? I didn't die. Don't worry. I made it. And before AA, I could make it about 5-6 days, I think was about my record. I was about 6 days sober, and I was just doing the meeting a day, and, like, I was fine for that hour, but the rest of the time I was awake, it was like I was just like a clenched fist. I was like, it was almost like a scream that was just searching for a mouth to be let out, and it's like life wasn't getting better all of a sudden. You know, I mean, I was like, I was just trying so hard to manage everything. You know, I was like logging my meetings in case there was a custody battle. I was just like everything. I felt like the floor had been wiped out below me, and like I was just groundless, and I was just clamoring for some sort of control and way to manage my life. It gets painful quick, you know. Some people like have a strong, like a longer pain tolerance, but like for me, it got on top of me quick, and like, I don't know, I fell asleep instead of going to the meeting that night, and then like I snapped awake. And I looked at the time, and I still had, like, 5 minutes before the meeting started. It was, like, 4 minutes away, so I just immediately left. And it was a small meeting, maybe 4 or 5 people, and I ended up meeting my sponsor that night. They said, does anyone have a topic? It was one of those meetings. Like, anyone have a topic? And I'm like, oh, I got one. I got one. And, like, I just exploded on the meeting, just verbal vomiting, you know, just, like, every problem I thought I had at that moment. And it's like... And it's like, if you're new, I know those problems are loud. They're really loud. The symptoms of alcoholism are loud. Alcoholism itself, the part that'll kill you, is quiet. And it's subtle. And it makes all these other things seem real important. So like when I'm working with a guy and he's like, he has to get the court fines paid off. He has to take care of the jail thing. He's got to get his job back. He's got to get the girl back. He's got to find a place to stay. And I mean, he's like, I understand how important these things seem, but you know, that's not what's going to kill you. What's going to kill you is that hole in the soul. And that's what I had. I remember my, like, after I met this guy, he took me to my first speaker meeting, and it's actually someone from out in this area. Patty B, she was my first person I ever heard speak, and she started talking about the hole in the soul, and it's like, I never heard that term before, but I knew exactly what she was talking about. So I had this illusion of just emptiness, this illusion that like, I just wasn't enough. And for whatever reason, when I put alcohol or whatever in my body, like, that feeling would go away for a little while. So of course I drink, you know? And then, like, all of a sudden, I got to not drink anymore, and that was my solution. And I still have that emptiness. I still have alcoholism, you know? I just didn't have the treatment of alcohol for alcoholism anymore. And thank God I met this dude. He got me real busy in Alcoholics Anonymous. First, he started talking to me a little bit about his drinking. Not my drinking, his drinking. And I could see myself in it. And when he saw that I was identifying, what he did is he started qualifying me. He asked me a few pointed questions about, you know, what happened when I drank, what happened when I didn't drink. How did I feel? Stuff like that. And once I had answered those questions to his satisfaction, like, and then we started right then, like outside of the steps, outside of the meeting, you know, he started taking me through the steps of AA, took me through the first 2 steps right there, And I went back to his place with him, and he gave me a big book. He gave me something to read out of the big book, and told me to read pages 60 to 63 and call him the next day. And all of a sudden, AA was existing for me outside of an AA meeting. And I know a lot of people really, really wrestle in early sobriety. That was about the end of my wrestling. And I know if you're wrestling right now, you're like, good for you, dude, you know. But it's my story, you know. I just got busy in Alcoholics Anonymous because I didn't have much else going on. And I had a pretty, pretty joyful time of it, you know. I mean, I went through a lot of stuff in early sobriety, too. Like, you know, I mean, I got evicted because I set up all the circumstances to get evicted. But the actual court date was when I was sober, and I was able to show up for it, and I was able to take responsibility, and like, that was a debt that I was able to pay off. And I didn't feel bad about it. I mean, I had, like, I've had relationship problems. I've moved, like, moving situations. I've had, like, work situations. I mean, all parenting situations, all sorts of stuff has come up. But I've been able to meet them with sober direction. Whereas, like, before, I was just kind of winging it and usually making things worse. Anyway, my sponsor got me really busy really quick, and he took me to my first home group, and we went on a lot of speaking commitments there, and sometimes the lights just go out, man, and no, but look, he got me writing my fourth step. And that was huge for me, because I never put it all down before. I never took a good, hard, honest look at myself before. And then, like, reading it to him, I was like, I mean, there was a lot of things that, I mean, I had a lot of guilt, a lot of shame and remorse, you know, for a lot of the stuff I did. I thought I was a pretty rotten person. When it came time, I didn't have a problem, like, with the whole God, you know, part of the program, or the God idea, you know. It's like when I got to my second step and he asked me if I was, like, if I thought there was something here that would turn, you know, that would help me, I was like, yeah, you know. But I didn't think that God really wanted a lot to do with me, because of all the stuff I had done. And what I found was God didn't actually turn his back on me. God didn't abandon me or anything like that because of the things I did. Acting out of self and being, like, self-willed and self-centered in that way, I was the one who was actually turning my back on God because I thought I could do it on my own. I was trying to be self-reliant. And the fourth and fifth step really helped me see that. And just like everyone else, you know, when I got to my fifth step, there was things that I wasn't going to tell anyone, and things that I was taking to the grave, and things that I just, I thought that was too much for even him. Turns out this guy was a thug, and, like, you know, there was, like, any time I would tell him something that was, like, as bad as, like, I was going to tell him, he was like, oh, yeah, okay, that's cool. Yeah, I did that too. He's like, how many times do you do it? I'm like, well, dude, once, it's bad. It's really bad. And he's like, well, you know, it's not so bad. You're not that unique, you know. We've all done this, you know. We've all hit cars, you know, and ran away from the scene of the accident. It's not uncommon. I was like, huh, okay, you know. And I didn't feel so bad. And basically, like, the first pass through inventory, I don't think I learned. I mean, 90% of the stuff I wrote down, I already knew. It's not like it was a big revelation. I mean, it's like, I did the stuff. I know what it was. But that part where it says the exact nature, you know, of our wrongs, that 10%, that part that was like, whoa, you know, when I could see that selfishness within my actions, to see how, like, that part of my story, played out, you know. That was crazy. That was really crazy. And like, you know, he helped me see that, like, that I didn't have to keep living that way, and that there was another way of life. And it's like, and just by looking at this stuff that I didn't like, I was kind of creating this, like, vision for my life moving forward and this like ideal of like the type of man that I could become. And then I was going to ask God for help with that. And that's what I did, you know, and then, you know, he took me through the amends and I have all my amends out in Jersey except for that one time I hit that parked car. I never found the driver. But aside from that, all my amends out there are done, you know, I don't like the term living amends, but like, cause I don't really know what that means. Everyone has like their own definition, but like for me, that's like, there are amends that are ongoing for sure. And like change that I've had to incorporate in my life that, you know, are going to be kind of an ongoing process. But aside from that, there's also a lot of damage out in Colorado. And like, I'm 9 years sober and I've made it back there probably 5 times since I've been sober. And each time I'll take like another bite out of the amends out there, but there's still a lot of work to do. And that's okay. You know, it's like, as long as I don't stagnate, you know, and you know, the last trip I was out there, actually my last 2 trips, I was focusing just on family stuff and I didn't actually go out and, you know, wasn't as proactive as I could have been, but it's okay, you know, it's like, because I know what to do, you know, and then there's always the next trip out there, so it's like an ongoing thing. And then like while I was doing that, you know, he took me through the through steps 10, 11, and 12 also, you know, and that's where I try to kind of keep my feet, you know. I'm a big 11-step guy now, and meditation is, like, huge. I start all my days, you know, it's like, that's my favorite part of the day is just establishing that contact, you know, with God. It's like, I think the contact's always there. It's just, like, the only thing that, you know, waxes and wanes is, like, my awareness of it. And that, you know, part in the morning, you know, where I, like I'll sit down and I start off, you know, in prayer. And then I, like, you know, I do a little reading and a little writing, and then I actually do like the, you know, traditional meditation as well as like the contemplation type meditation. And it's like, I love that part of my day. And that's how I, you know, kind of get centered, you know, and set out to do this stuff. And I've had a couple sponsors in AA, and none of them have asked anything of me, you know, for all that they gave me, all the time they gave me, none of them asked me for anything other than when I was done, or when I got this thing, not when I was done, but when I got this thing, that I do my best to pass it on to others. And I've done my best to honor that, you know. My first sponsor, his name was George, we ended up becoming roommates, and kind of became more friends than sponsors, and he was going more into NA, and I wasn't, you know, it's just in AA, and around that time, I switched sponsors, and, like, because, you know, we just sort of remained friends and stuff, you know, over time, he ended up moving out and moved down to South Carolina his family was down there, and to be with his daughter and his parents and stuff, and man, he was one of those guys who sponsored a ton of people, and like, and it didn't matter who you were, he could like tailor, he was like really good at tailoring sponsorship to different people. Like if someone needed like a softer approach or a softer touch, he was really good at that. And if someone like needed like to have their butt kicked a little bit, he was really good at that too. He was just like one of those guys, and he was always really busy in AA and then NA when he started doing that. But then like he moved down there and he never plugged back in. And it's like, and you don't unwind that kind of sobriety real fast, but you do unwind it. And like, I don't know, this is around a year ago. It was last April, maybe two Aprils ago, I guess. And like, it was his birthday. I wished him a happy birthday on Facebook or whatever. And then like a month later, like the response was like, you know, Georgie knows who reached out to him for his birthday. You know, thanks everyone. And it's like, that's weird, you know? And so I kind of investigated, and it turns out his sister ended up getting control of his Facebook account, which I guess is something that happens when you die. And what happened is he had gotten some dirty dope out there and he OD'd, and it's because he never, like, and like, you're in here long enough, people like die, and you just, you get, I hate to say it, but you get used to it. But like sometimes you get close to someone and it affects you a little bit more. And then like, and I would tell people, you know, it's like, God, George died. And they're like, yep, it happens. It's like the same thing I would tell someone who like when I wasn't that close to someone. And it's like a lot of lessons in that, you know, a lot of lessons. It's like, but it was kind of the first close death to me, you know. And I don't usually share about that. That hit me. Sorry. I know what to do now, and it's just to honor that thing that he asked me to pass it on to others. Because it's like there's something that's just like really neat that happens when I work with other alcoholics. It's like that. What I learned in AA, after reading the big book and then like seeing my own experience matched up to what I learned, was that the problem definitely resides in my mind. Too much thinking? Here's the thing. Sometimes I think I'm the solution. I'm not the solution. Problem, you know? And it's like, I think it is the most valuable thing that I have in AA is to at least always have at least one guy who when they call, you're like, If you've been working with like others yet, it's like you may know what I'm talking about. That one guy who's just like takes up all your time and just like, and he's just so demanding. And it's like, and that's my man. That's the guy that I always try to have. I mean, I get you know a few sponsees now, and some of them are like pretty low maintenance. They've been through the steps. They're helping others themselves, and it's like when they call, it's like usually they're just talking about the guys they sponsor. Or questions that they have, but it's like, but when I have that fresh guy who's just like a pain in the butt, man, he's the one that saves my butt. He's the one that'll interrupt my thinking. He's the one that'll, cause when I get those calls, I'm usually like in my head, you know, where the problem is. And then I'll get the call and then I get to worry about someone else's problem. There's this weird like little thing in AA or this weird principle that like there's not enough room in my head for my problems and yours. And if I'm focusing on yours, mine get dealt with on their kind of on their own. And then sometimes I'll be like talking to a guy and he'll call and there's this phenomenon that happens that's like, it's just amazing to me. It's like usually a guy will call and he'll like be talking. His problem is the exact same problem that I just talked about with my sponsor or that I had just gone through with, you know, with my sponsor. And it's like, and I just gotten to the other side of and learned the solution to. It's always the same solution, you know, just more God. But it's like, it's uncanny, you know, how often that happens. And like, it doesn't even surprise me anymore. It amazes me, but it doesn't surprise me because it's like so commonplace. And it's like, it's like I'm not even telling them what to do. I just tell them what I did, and I just like don't let them know that I had just done it. But you know, but it's like that part of that part of AA, that part of being able to give back and being able to watch other guys grow in this program has just been huge for me. Not 2 weeks ago, a dude called me and he just graduated college after 10 years. He didn't get a doctorate. He's just an alcoholic going to college. It took him 10 years. And another guy, he actually just got his GED. He came into Alcoholics Anonymous with a trash bag full of clothes, and that was it. That's all he had. And then he went to getting a job, then like a better job and a better job. And he ended up getting his GED, and now he's working towards getting his license back and stuff. And it's like, and I get to watch these things, you know? I get to watch someone come out of a fifth step who maybe has been wrestling with something since childhood. And they all of a sudden get to see it a different way, and all of a sudden it's not eating their lunch anymore. And they get to approach life in a different direction. And it's like, and you can always see the moment when it happens. It's just like you could see, it's like something turns in their head, in their mind, you know, in their eyes. You see it. It's really cool. I get to watch. It's not even anything I'm doing. I just get to, I get a seat for that. And all I had to do was like drink an insane amount of alcohol, like for 15 years. That's it. I had to just drive my life into the ground and then boom, I get this amazing seat. You know, and it's like I guess I always grew up. I never really felt like I I guess one of the things that set me apart from non-alcoholics, that from what I could tell, and this is just my perspective, so it was probably wrong, was that everyone else, all the other guys, seemed to have this rite of passage that they would go through to where they went from being boys to men. And I didn't feel like I ever got that. I felt like I was like Peter Pan, you know? I was like just one of the lost boys in Neverland, and I never had to grow up. And even when I wanted to, I couldn't, you know? And I didn't feel like I had a purpose in everything that I was doing. I was like doing for someone else. And it was just a feeling, like I was trying to make my parents proud or something with every action, and I couldn't. And I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, and after I went through the steps, like all of a sudden I had a purpose. And I had like I wasn't doing it for me, I wasn't doing it for other people, I was just doing it, and it was the right thing. And I knew that, I could feel it. And it's like that rite of passage I felt like I had experienced by that point. And now I get to live a life that's not ruled by alcohol. It's like every decision isn't based around this like tiny little aspect of life, you know? It's like I get to actually live life, and I've healed so many relationships, you know, through the amends process, and I get to actually show up for my life today in a way that I never thought I was able to. And that's huge. That's huge. I know, I think we're almost at the hour. I'll close with this. I mean, it's like I found that any time I've gone out speaking, I'm much less likely to even think about alcohol. You know, and I feel that I'm a lot safer from ever having to go back to that way of life. Every time I get to speak, you know, and for that, I wanted to thank you guys for keeping me sober another day. And thanks again, Jeff, for bringing me out. All right, thank you.